The White Network presents The Heretic's Hour with Carolyn Yeager.
And good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to The Heretic's Hour, coming to you live from the White Network on this last day of September 2013. My goodness, there are only 3 months left to 2013. Is it possible? I feel like saying, 2013, we hardly knew you. You flew by so quickly. Well, tonight's overall theme is on how to overcome the Jews' built-in protections for themselves from the rest of us. That is, they're protecting themselves from the rest of us. And this is a subject I take very seriously, and I'm going to be serious tonight, and I have a lot to cover, so I'm going to get right into it. But something came up right before the program, or around 5 p.m. today. I happened to see a link to something from my Elie Wiesel website, an article, Elie Wiesel in Buchenland. And I thought, well, I clicked on it, and it didn't take me to Elie Wiesel Kanza World, but it took me to Andrew Winkler's website, therebel.org. How shocked I was to find that he has taken copyrighted material. This particular article is copyrighted, and almost everything I have at Elie Wiesel Kanza World is copyrighted, and quite a bit of material from my from CarolynYeager.net is copyrighted, but it's a lot of my blogs and radio programs are not. But still, he has taken a whole lot of material from both websites, it appears. I didn't really study the page that I saw. And he has put my name, he has uploaded it to his site, and he has put me on his list of bloggers on his left-hand column. This is therebel.org, ladies and gentlemen. It's HTTP, therebel.org. It's called the Rebel blog or something, but that's not in the URL. And so I saw my name on the side there, and I clicked on there, and there's this whole page full of stuff of mine. And when you click on it, it doesn't take you to my websites. It takes you to, you know, his pages on his site where he has uploaded the entire of my pages. And therefore, people don't have to come to my website. They can just stay on his. And, you know, I've talked about him previously. He knows how I feel about him. So he has not asked permission to do this, to use my work or to put me on his blog as one of his bloggers. He has not mentioned anything to me at all and asked whether I was considered whether I wanted to be there. And so I am pointing it out right now tonight in my program, and I'm asking people who know him and who are one of his on his list of bloggers, and I believe contact him and inform him that I don't want to be there, and if he has any kind of scruples, he will remove me immediately. I sent him an email, which was it's not easy to find a contact for him, but it's at editor@ therebel.org. That's what it is, editor@therebel.org. He's got another one, admin@therebel.org, but that one came back. It's no good, but I think the one got to him. If it doesn't get to him, I'm asking other people who know him to get to him and tell him that he can't just put people's stuff on there this way and add people to his blog without asking them. And he, as a matter of fact, knows that I would say no, that I don't want to be there. We've been into it, you know, he and I, and I've also made some views known recently on a discussion site that I think he is also on but never says anything. But anyway, people know him. People have probably told him. And he may be, I don't know why he's done this, if he's trying to tie me up in some kind of legal wrangle or something. I want to let people know about it. And I also noticed that he had more names than he had the last time I looked there, which I don't go there, but I was talking to some other people about him, and that's why I went there before and looked over his site again. His new design, and now he's got some more changes, but he has a lot more names there. And I really wonder if he has asked a lot of these people, and if there's also people there who don't even know that they're on there. I wouldn't be at all surprised, because I sure didn't know. And I'm not happy about it. You might think I'd be happy to be anywhere. No, I'm not. I don't want to be associated with Andrew Winkler at all. In my opinion, he's an internet shyster and has been ever since he started his first website, Zyopedia, several years ago. He's an Australian, and he knows I don't like him. And so, you know, he needs to cease and desist this nonsense and take me off of his site and remove everything that's there. I don't want his help, and I think that he gets help from these bloggers whose websites he takes things from more than he helps them, and I don't want to be associated with him. So I have to stop on that right now so I can get my program done. And I will go on to say that the Jewish people have had, from the very beginning of their so-called history, I would say, the idea of and recognize the importance of protecting themselves at the same time as they aggressively attack and plunder outsiders. They did and still do recognize the importance of simultaneous use of both battle thrusts, that is what was I saying there from the very beginning? But they're to protect themselves and at the same time, you know, go after the other. They do the both. They do both. They don't just attack others, but they have also set up elaborate methods to protect themselves. And so that's how they operate, I think. And their design is to steal, kill, and rape. In other words, to plunder and enslave as much otherhood as possible. Now, I know that when we talk about their biblical history, that it gets a little bit, the Christian identists get unhappy, but I am talking here from what the Jews believe about themselves, and I'll stick with that, and I know it still is not satisfactory to people, but it works for me. You know, this is how the Jews think about themselves, and this is their picture of themselves from going back into biblical times and so on, even though I don't believe that they were those people either. But their ostensible belief is that they need this Jewish state, which they call Eretz Israel, as the home. And I took this from a Jewish website. Of Meir Kahane. They need this Jewish state as the home of a divine, chosen, special people, cloaked in holiness and wrapped in the mantle of difference. That's a quote. And they are and must be recognized as, quote, God's special people who were blessed with the divine truth at Sinai that raised this people above the common and profane, and divided them from the nations who know not holiness and sanctity. So, you know, that is, they talk about all the rest of mankind as the nations, and they are something, you know, above and beyond that, who are God's special people. This is what they believe. They really do believe it. And even those who are not religious Jews accept this basically, that they have this destiny, that perhaps Jews have a destiny to rule, and so much in their, not just their religion, but their sacred books and so on, and their history books tell them these things. And I'm not going to go into all this tonight, but I'm not an expert on it, but, you know, so that they feel that they don't do any wrong. You know, they don't do any wrong because they're in God's will. Now, their overriding concern, I think, is to make the world safe for Jews. And that brought to my mind, I mentioned, we were talking, Hasso and I, on Saturday about the slogans for World War One and the one to make the world safe for democracy. The Great War was, they're trying to justify all the horror of that war by saying, well, it's going to make the world safe for democracy. We have to do that, and then everything will be hunky-dory from now on, you know, once we win this. naturally, it wasn't, but they feigned concern, the Jews, for other minorities, such as blacks especially, but it is only to weaken whites, who they see as their ancient enemy and main obstacle to the Jewish messianic conquest and world rulership that they're looking forward to. So they're united worldwide, and they do their thing. Now, our job, I think, is to show that they are united for their own interests only, and that this is not acceptable, because people find what they do acceptable or excusable because so many seem to believe that it's based as so many seem to believe that and agree with them on that it's based entirely on the Holocaust, the so-called Holocaust. It's entirely based on that, that what they do, even though it wouldn't be acceptable for other people, it's acceptable for them because they're a special, they have a special case, and they suffered a genocide, they suffered an attempted extermination, and therefore they have a right to have this super concern over their own welfare and protecting themselves and so on. You know, the idea of never again. And it's very real. And all kinds of non-Jews accept it. If it weren't pushed by governments, I think they wouldn't, but it's pushed by governments. So this is how the Jews have managed to build up such a protection racket for themselves that even amongst all the governments of the world. And everything is allowed for them, because they have a right to be concerned about another genocide, because they were genocided once. Now, we know that this is false, and we know how powerful the revisionist arguments are. But still in all, mass media seems to trump everything, plus government support. So people continue to basically go along with the idea that there was this Holocaust of the Jews. Now, this to me is their greatest protection. I would like someone to really put up a good argument that it's not their greatest protection, that they have something else. Someone spoke in a comment today that, well, he agreed that this was the Holocaust had to be dealt with head on, directly, and all that. But he said, we also have to deal with the fact that the Jews, what was it that he said? The Jews get away with, maybe he meant the media power or whatever, that the Jews have all these privileges and so on. Well, sure, but they go together, you see. You can't separate those two things. So they're not two different things, but really, one thing, I didn't describe what he had said properly, I don't believe. But anyway, you can find it in the comments at the White Network under last Saturday's show if you go there and look. But I say, you know, I'm saying that this is the greatest protection for the Jews that exists. And it's the secret of their self-protection racket since 1945, and they did have the racket, as I've already indicated. They've had this going on from the very beginning, but it's been something they call anti-Semitism, which they still use. It's been anti-Semitism that they are able to point to their unpopularity with people as being somehow as not being anything to do with them, but being only to do with the other people who have a problem with hating Jews for no reason and this anti-Semitism. Now, this didn't work as well as the Holocaust because in all these years, you know, many countries kicked them out. Many people disliked the Jews and spoke against the Jews and put Jews in confined areas to protect non-Jews and put Jews in what the Jews then called ghettos and did a lot of things and prevented Jews from participating fully in the communities and in business and industry and so on, and did all these things because of what Jews would always do when they were allowed to the freedom to do what they wanted to do. And they were moving around. Also, they were spreading around the world into all these different nations and forming, you know, their networks and so on. And therefore, they were more capable of working, of enriching themselves and making laws in their favor and so on. So they constantly were being, you know, pushed back. But after 1945, that pushback has never happened again. And it's like it cannot happen because, well, look what happened when the German nation tried to get rid of them all, which had happened before in the past. And it was all right, but not this time. It wasn't all right because they created, during these years of the early 1941 to 1945, they created this myth of the Holocaust. And because it was wartime and because the Americans and English were vicious enemies of the Germans, I mean total enemies, and they were in total war, and the French too, they didn't have much play there, and other Europeans that got involved there, but they then had these allies with the Anglo-Americans, the Jews did, and with the Soviet Union. I can't forget the Soviet Union, so that they all cooperated with this Holocaust mythology, and they are still cooperating to this day because they are guilty of so much, and they have they were able to put all the guilt on the Germans and on the National Socialist regime at the end of the war, and they don't want anything to change that. So that's how we got so allied, although we were allied before that, but even more so. That's how I would say, yeah, England and America and then Russia too, but in a different way, continue to back this fake Holocaust because it's in their interest. And of course, we know why the Jews do it. So there you've got something very powerful that the Jews have put together as part of their self-protection. And they are really being protected now by all of this. But to get back to the anti-Semitism, they still use anti-Semitism, and they're bringing it up a lot in recent times. But here's the reason. What's interesting is that the reason that anti-Semitism doesn't go away, their reasoning is that it's because white European people are just naturally anti-Semitic. And it's their problem. They have this mental problem about it. They have this huge problem. But the real reason is because Jews are constantly manufacturing anti-Semitism. They either create incidents themselves that appear to be, you know, hostile to themselves, or they report incidents that never occurred, you know, in all their channels, including the media, or they use Jewish organizations, which they have invented, which they have created, like the Southern Poverty Law Center, the Anti-Defamation League, and things like the United States Department, U.S. State Department office that is run by Jews only, that department that's set up to monitor and report anti-Semitic events around the world. That was put in place because the Jews wanted it, and they run it. And then all of these, I don't even have to mention all these museums like the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum and all over the world, and more of them being built all the time. So, but that's to keep the Holocaust going. But these other things are to make people believe that there's such a thing as anti-Semitism going on, which the Jews have to protect themselves from. So you've got these two things, but really it's the anti-Semitism has always been there, but the Holocaust is the new one that makes them have such powerful protection today. And this is what has to cease for us in our own interests. This we must stop protecting Jews from their just deserts. I mean, but it's us, it's our people who are protecting them. And they engineer this, of course, in all these ways I mentioned. And of course, I didn't go into, could go into a lot of detail, but I don't think I need to for you people who are listening to me, and I don't want to take the time to do that. So this is what they've done, and their lies are becoming way over the top, which I'm going to look into some of this tonight. And I'm going to, but first, I want to cover some interesting items in the news that relates to all of this. And I think it's worth taking the time to do this because it kind of is background for what this new book that's come out that I'm going to talk about. And I have to give myself the whole second hour to cover that book and the author of that book, I think. And if it doesn't take me that long, well, I can come back to something else, or maybe somebody will want to call in about it. But so I'm going to do as much of this other that as I can in this first hour, and it's already 22 minutes after. So I'm going to start with this story that was appeared yesterday. Jewish vandals smashed tombstones in Jerusalem Christian Cemetery. This was, as it says, in Jerusalem. And four suspected Jewish nationalists there were arrested. They call them Jewish nationalists, you see. Do they ever call white people nationalists? Never, never. They call them extreme right-wingers or neo-Nazis or hate people committing hate crimes and so on. But these here they call their own people Jewish nationalists. And they were arrested for smashing headstones in a Christian cemetery in Jerusalem. And there were four of them. Two were settlers from the occupied West Bank. And they were throwing concrete blocks at about 15 tombstones when they were caught by, and this is according to police spokesman Mickey Rosenfeld. If you read these things from Israel, you've seen his name before. I think he's chief of police or something in Israel, head of the police, major police force. And it says that, several of the headstones had, their stone crosses broken off of them. So they were aiming at the crosses. So it was a religious hate crime, if you want to call it a hate crime. I don't know if they have hate crimes in Israel, but they would call it that here. Wherever Jews are, Jews would call it that if we were doing it. And they said two of these men were known Hilltop Youth Activists, which is a fringe group of Jewish settlers that are suspected by authorities of vandalizing several mosques and monasteries in the past few years. So they're vandalizing religious structures. They're vandalizing Islamic mosques and Christian monasteries. So that's even more that it's all about religion for them. They don't want non-Jewish people, people of other religions in their country. And yet this Rosenfeld said their motive was nationalistic. Their motive was nationalistic. Now it's not surprising that this happens in Israel, that they're doing this. They, you know, they're in control. They use the language they want to use. And nothing's going to happen to these four. You know that. I mean, I'm quite sure. They're age between 17 and 26. there because they were just overly enthused from their nationalism. You know, they'll give them some little something, but they won't. You know, it's no way a religious hatred. It's not going to be characterized as that, but it is. Now, in the Washington Post, on September 27th, there was an article called Decades After Holocaust, Germany Asks What It Owes Jews. It's a pretty interesting article because it comes from Koblenz, Germany, which is a what they call a small city of about 106,000 people. And they're having a little thing going on between the Jews there and some property that was there, used to be their synagogue, that's been sold to a developer for to do a very good and helpful and important development in the city that the city wants very much to happen. And these Jews had no interest in this old synagogue of theirs, which they no longer own. Here's what happened. Let me just kind of start from the beginning. The city is cash strapped, and the mayor agreed that it was a good idea, and I guess the city council, whatever, they opted to sell the site of an old synagogue to an investor, which disregarded the desires of the Jewish community to buy back its pre-Holocaust home. Well, at one time, this belonged to the Jewish community there, but it's a kind of a long story. But it got bombed in 1945, and they didn't want it anymore because it wasn't worth anything, and they sold it to the city, and the city bought it from them. And they were a very small group then because there weren't all that many there to begin with, and a lot of them left or were gone, and so they're just a small little tattered group, I guess, and didn't have any money. So they are happy to sell that and get it and get money from the city. Then they, but now they're crying about that the city won't give it back to them. They want the city to give it back to them. Now there are now 977 Jews in Koblenz out of 106,000 population. And it says that's more than were there before Hitler came to power in 1933. And you know, Jews have been given lots of special attention in Germany all these years, and we know how they're treated there. And it, you know, at one time the government passed a law that all Jews from the Soviet Union could come to Germany almost with no questions asked. I mean, there might have been some of them that they refused, but mostly they accepted any Jew from the Soviet Union as some kind of atonement for, you know, what happened under the National Socialists or during the war. And so, but luckily a lot of Jews still didn't want to come to Germany then, so not that many of them came. And there's, now they say there's about 100,000 Jews in Germany. That's only Jews who consider themselves part of the Jewish community. It's only who call themselves Jews. So there's a lot more than that because in Germany, a whole lot of Jews don't call themselves Jews, and you're not allowed to call somebody Jew unless they say they are, or they, you know, they say you can do that. They say, yeah, I'm Jewish. Otherwise, a lot of them refuse to acknowledge that, and you're not allowed to say that they say to call them that. So this, but then they stopped the Russian program, and things quieted down. And I'm trying to skip ahead here a little bit. But these Russian Jews who did come, they say they had little money and tremendous needs. Wouldn't you know? I mean, you know, they came for the better welfare programs or the better benefits they were going to get in Germany than they had in Russia, for sure. And so they came, you know, with their hands out, expecting to be just treated like kings and queens. But now they're crying about them because they don't, you know, they're in need still. They still haven't made a made a success of themselves in Germany. But the mayor, now this, okay, I have to add that it's not surprising that at the end of World War II, the city of Koblenz was largely leveled by Allied bombing, and then it was rebuilt, you know, the Germans rebuilt it, and at that time they decided to sell this former synagogue building, which was not in good shape. Well, they had rebuilt it. I think I kind of skipped this part. I was going to read it all and not skip around because then I miss things. But the city, after they bought this old synagogue from the city, they rebuilt it into something that looked the same, but they used it for something else. You know, they used it for some kind of offices and schools or whatever. And then, so now, the city, the mayor said that the city was, had decided to, sell this former building. It wasn't a synagogue anymore. It hadn't been for a long time, but, to an investor. And, he said that the decision to do that was easy. He said the, topic of reparations isn't in play here. Things were rectified after World War II. That's what this mayor says. Good for him. He says, you know, we're not dealing in reparations to Jews anymore. That's done. You know, that's already been rectified. So, you know, he says that was rectified when the Jewish community took possession of that synagogue back after World War II and decided to sell it to the city because they had no use for it and it wasn't in very good shape. And that's when the city, you know, eventually rebuilt it when they were rebuilding the whole city and was using it for something. And this mayor says it can't be that suddenly after 70 years, something that had been settled becomes unclear again. Because, and he added that his grandfather was Jewish. This mayor, too bad, but anyway. But he's, these Jews now are just, you know, whining and crying that they want it back because now they see some value that other people are putting on it and they have a little more money now. But they don't have enough money to renovate it. Let's see. This is the same story again. Now here's this, Jew, 91-year-old Heinz Kahn, who is head of Koblenz's Jewish community and who shows his Auschwitz number on his left arm. He was in Auschwitz. But you know what? It's supposed to be a death camp, but he didn't die there. He wasn't put to death. He came out of it and is still alive at the age of 91, so he's doing pretty damn well. I guess he wasn't... he wasn't harmed too much. His health wasn't harmed too much while he was in there. But he says, this Kahn, representing the Jewish community in Koblenz, we did not count on a Jewish community developing back then, he says. The Jewish community of Koblenz had been completely destroyed. So they were destroyed, small in numbers, so they sold that thing which had even been given back to them by the city, and then they sold it to the city. So the city was treating them pretty darn well in that regard. But they say now they've been growing, and 35 children put on pageants and study stories from the Torah every weekend at the cramped post-war synagogue on the grounds of the old Jewish cemetery. But some observant Jews refuse to pray there because they say it goes against the teachings to have a synagogue at the same place where the dead are buried. So I see there's a cemetery that's built over a cemetery, or there's a cemetery close enough there. Anyway, you know, this is all from the past, but some of these old Jews won't pray there, so they need a new synagogue, and they want that one that they used to have a long time ago and sold. Anyway... but they don't have the $77.5 million that are needed for renovations of this building. I don't know if it's some kind of safety thing that's needed, or they just would need that much to do something with it, but they don't have the money. And this other guy who's a German Jew who emigrated from Azerbaijan said the Jewish community in 2013 truly is poor. But before 1945, it was rich, and the people were killed. So this is supposed to make the city feel guilty and give the Jews what they want. But luckily, these leaders are not open to that. You know, they've toughened up, and they say that there's $675 million in debt, the city government, and they need, you know, they're trying to bring themselves out of debt. They're trying to make the city more economically healthy, and they say they cannot do anything to help these Jews, nor, they say, are they under any obligation to do so. That's the part I like. They don't feel at all guilty, none of them. They say they're not under any obligation, and this is a ridiculous, well, they don't say that, but it is a ridiculous request of these Jews, but they'll try anything, you know. The investor who won the bid is one of the richest men in Koblenz. He's Peter Gurlitz. He made a fortune from founding and selling a company that makes devices that help renewable energy integrate into the electricity grid. Now he wants to start an institute that would study sustainability, and city leaders hope bring desperately needed euros into the local economy. Now that's somebody and something that Adolf Hitler would have liked. Adolf Hitler liked forward thinking, modern ideas of how to make life better for the Germans. He would have liked that very much. And the city managers and so on like it too. So so Gorlitz bought this old synagogue site, which is an empty building. And then he also bought an empty building next door to it, and a third one down the street. And he's going to, you know, do his renovation. He's going to make his, he's going to turn it partly into student apartments and a restaurant. It's going to connect to classrooms and lecture halls next door. It's going to be apartment rentals and food sales that would help fund the project. Well, he says he's pouring $20 million into the renovations. And he needs a synagogue building. Without that, the plans are no go. So everybody's saying no to these Jews, and thank goodness. But guess what? There are some dissenting voices within the city leadership. And where do they come from? You're not going to be surprised. A member of the city council who is in the opposition Green Party. Now, you know the Green Party is the ultra-left party in Germany and in Europe. This party member named Seidel, if he says, quote, "It's not just an economic question. It's a moral question. It's a historical question. If there hadn't been the Holocaust, then there'd be a synagogue there. And we'd have a Jewish community here. They're the heirs to the German Jewish community." So you see how these liberals think. I mean, super liberals. You know, they're always on the Jew side. And they love to use the Holocaust the same way the Jews do. And he's saying, well, if it hadn't been for the Holocaust, they would still have their synagogue. Nothing would have changed. And therefore, it would be the better thing to give them what they want. But you see, it's not just the Holocaust. It was the war. We already learned that the Allied bombs destroyed those buildings, some of them. So just about all of them. So they never want to mention that. They never want to mention what the Allies did, what the English and the Americans did. They just want to mention, you know, the Holocaust. So that's just an example of the way that the Jews operate, but it's also good to see that somebody in Germany is no longer going along with their situation. I hope that spreads. So let's see. I want to move on a little bit to the financial situation. Well, everybody knows that tonight at midnight is the big moment for the government to shut down. I don't have time to go into this after all. This article, it's pretty interesting, but it does show how, I'll just say this, the point I'm making, I was going to make with it, is that Wall Street equals the Jews, and all the efforts of not just the financial people, but they've got all Americans worrying about Wall Street, you know, having a, you know, crashing and or the stock market and so on. And we all feel like, I say we, but, you know, all Americans basically feel like that's a bad thing and they have to protect it. And if anything is going to make the market go way down, well, that we should avoid that and all. But who is being protected? Because it's all Jewish. It's all Jewish finance. It's almost, you know, all Jews are running all these big funds and in all these investment banks and Wall Street firms and so on. So, again, it's all about they have figured out how to get all Americans by, you know, all most Americans have they have pension funds. They have other kind of you know, general retirement funds and so on. And they're all, even if they don't themselves have a portfolio of stocks or something, they are subject to what happens on Wall Street and the stock market, and they know it. And then, you know, they say, oh, this all went down and, you know, we're having all this. And then there's unemployment, you know, the economy crashes and so on. So they've got everybody involved in protecting their interests again. So but I'm going to have to skip this and go on to it's very interesting, though. Go on to the story about the upcoming January 27th International Holocaust Remembrance Day, and the story from Arutz Sheva, in which a delegation of 60 Knesset members, headed by Yuli Yoel Edelstein, is scheduled to travel to the Auschwitz-Birkenau death camps. Notice they call them death camps here, even though you get all these people who are survivors from there. And this was, this was just today, I think I found this, saw this. No, the other day, a couple days ago, maybe. And this, so they're planning to have this delegation of Knesset members, they call them KMs, to go there, and they're going to have a discussion on the struggle against anti-Semitism. So they're bringing up, you know, the anti-Semitism again. And I'll bet the theme of this upcoming, which is in January 2014, but in International Holocaust Remembrance Day, will be about anti-Semitism. I bet it will be focused on that, because that's their big thing now. And it's going to, the delegation will also include Holocaust survivors, naturally. This is from Israel. You know, this is the Israeli group. Senior members of the Israel Defense Forces, Israel's chief rabbis, and representatives of Israel's student unions, representing a link between the past and the future. And they want to illustrate that anti-Semitism is not just a Jewish issue. And I'm going to point out that, if I haven't already, that anti-Semitism is one of the important things. Well, I guess that's coming up here. All right. Senior government and parliamentary figures from around the world will be in attendance. Nobel laureate and Holocaust survivor Elie Wiesel will be a part of the delegation from the United States. Of course, he's always there. He gives the same speech. You know, it doesn't matter what he says. People are all in awe of what he says, even though it's the same thing all the time. But and this event, I guess the event from Israel, I'm not sure what they mean by this event, but the Israel delegation event maybe is the initiative of Johnny Daniels, a new immigrant to Israel from England, as well as he's also founder and executive director of From the Depths, a nonprofit organization devoted to preserving the memory of the Holocaust and connecting the Jewish past with the Jewish future. Well, that's the new thing that they're doing too. We have to keep the past alive in the future. And you know, when you think, I've never heard of From the Depths, so how many Holocaust promoting organizations are there? There must be thousands. He just created a new one. And they never have too many. They're just constantly being created, and these events are being created. So I say that we need to plan a big revisionist event for January 27th in 2014. On that very day, I think it would be perfect. Now, I'm sure there are people who will say that, oh, that's too much in their face, you know. That's their day, and you can't try to do something revisionist. You'll just look bad. They'll call you names and hater and all this stuff. I think it's important to do it on that day. Otherwise, it wouldn't get any attention. That's the only way to get attention from it. And even so, they would try to ignore it after they've slammed it some. But I'm just thinking about this, you know, and what could it be? What would it be about? It would make the Jews furious to do something on this day. This is their day, you know. And based on this article, I think that this Connor Remembrance Day should feature first that Auschwitz-Birkenau was not a death camp, which has already been proven over and over and can continue to be. And two, second, that anti-Semitism is just a Jewish issue. That's what I was thinking about earlier, because they're trying to push, and this is one of the things that Elie Wiesel gets on these days, although he hardly says anything. But when he does, it's that anti-Semitism is not just a problem for Jews. It's a problem for everybody, because it means that there's all this prejudice around, and that affects everybody. Well, anti-Semitism is only important to Jews. And Jews, you know, are the only ones who complain about it and care about it, and they want to get other people to do so. That's one of the things they're working on now. And also this idea of calling Auschwitz-Birkenau a death camp. Now they're going to, you know, they're kind of in trouble with that, because this January 27th date for the Remembrance Day for the whole Holocaust was set quite a long time ago. And at that time, you know, January 27th is the date that supposedly, allegedly, the Russians, the Soviet Red Army, liberated Auschwitz-Birkenau. That's not even accurate, but even so, you know, and at that time, Auschwitz-Birkenau was the big killing center. And it, you know, 4 million deaths there. Now it's been reduced to 1.1 million, and the numbers that out in the Action Reinhardt camps that the new revisionist book is talking about, Treblinka, Belzec, and Sobibor, have gone up, or they've become more important. And so it's kind of interesting that they're holding this at Auschwitz-Birkenau as traditionally, and they can't really change that. If they would change it, it would put a big question mark about why they're changing it, because somehow the facts have changed. And they're then doing something revisionist. So, but you know, you can show that, that there was no gas chambers at Auschwitz-Birkenau. And that's where they're talking about all this. And they just have to keep everybody quiet. And that's why I think we shouldn't be quiet, and we should have this big thing. And I would be willing to travel. I don't like to travel too much, but I would travel if it wasn't too far away, you know, if it was in some fairly central location, so that it was not too far for anybody to go to. I would definitely take the time and trouble and so on to attend this. I think it would be a very good idea. And my other comments here, we need to counter the religious element of the Holocaust too. And this could be done. The International Holocaust Remembrance Day has become a sacred day in the Jewish calendar, and they want to make it, you know, a sacred day to everybody. And it's part of that, you know, they want to make it a world religion, a world sacred day to memorialize Jews, because that's what you're memorializing on this day. They don't want it, they don't want other people to get in on it too much. You know, it's all about Jews. And they point out that we can point out that the religious belief can't be forced. These are all things that have, you know, are talked about, but this would be a good time to do it. We can't force, if it's really functioning like a world religion or a religion of the Jews that all the rest of the world has to acknowledge and kind of bow down to and so on, then you can't force religion on people. And why is it criminalized? Why does it harm Jews, as they say it does, for people not to accept their story about 6 million deaths? Why does that do any harm to Jews? Does it harm Jews if I do not believe in their religion of Judaism? You know, all kinds of people. No, you don't have to believe in their religion of Judaism. It doesn't harm them. But if you don't believe in their religion of Holocaust, it does harm them. Well, in these states like Germany and Austria, and some of the others are similar to this, if maybe not quite so extreme, they pass laws that if you diminish what the beliefs are about the 6 million deaths of the Jews in the Holocaust and the concentration camps and so on, if you diminish that or say, well, what do you do? I guess it's somehow saying it didn't happen. You are somehow causing people to hate the Jews. You know, if you say the Jews, I don't think this story is true, then that is causing public hatred of Jews. Now, that hasn't been proven. They couldn't prove that. Because it doesn't do that, but that's what they say. And that's how they get around that. But it really makes no sense. And the more we can question all of this as to this crazy Holocaust religion and these sacred days and so on, the better it is for us. And this would be a great opportunity to do it. So I'm going to talk about it. I'm going to contact people about it and see if there's any, you know, positive response to it. There could be a kind of a festival atmosphere with speeches, educational meetings, and of course literature for sale. But it shouldn't be all just like the usual thing. It should have some really good people speaking and making these points and trying to get it into the news. Well, I got through all that, and I've still got a few minutes in this hour, so I'm just going to introduce my main topic for tonight, which is this book called Hitler's Furies, written by Wendy Lauer. Now, she could maybe be considered the female Daniel Goldhagen, I think, because she is a respected academic, for what that's worth, and she has very good credentials as far as I can see. And I don't know what her race is. I thought, well, she must be Jewish, and what she's written, it has to be. She has to be Jewish, I think, in my mind. Yet I couldn't find anything about her early, you know, her birth or anything. But I did find a picture of her, a couple of pictures of her. She's a fairly nice-looking blonde woman, maybe in her 40s in this picture, and I think that was probably about the age she is right now. So she's not, you know, she's not just a youngster. She's been around, and she's written a few things, and so, you know, she's taken seriously, and she is taken seriously. She has, as I said, she has good credentials. And she's studied a lot in Germany. She's been in a lot of German universities. All those Germans, you know, they love to have these Holocaust believing people in their universities and help them out and so on. But her on one of her pages, it was a very recent one about her academic credentials. It's listed under areas of expertise, just one thing, Holocaust. Holocaust is her specialty. And like I said, she's blonde. She doesn't look Jewish. But Lauer, well, could be anything. But, you know, here's another clue, though, that I think she might be Jewish. First, the way she writes. And then, and that she's so focused on this subject matter. And then that in all everything you look up for her, and she doesn't actually have a Wikipedia page. It just starts at her bachelor's, you know, at where she started her schooling, working on for her BA. Starts in 1985-86 when she was in the University of Vienna, and went to some other places, and she's, you know, and all of that, but. There's nothing about who her parents are or where she was born or, you know, what her religion is. Nothing like that. And it's usually these Jews who don't want to be, who aren't that easy to typify as Jews and don't want to be known as Jews who do this, who don't allow that early biographical information to come out. So that's a little introduction to her. And a little more about her. We still got a couple seconds here. Oh yeah. Well, I was. I will mention that next week we will have new break music on this show. But it's today we still have Frank Reneke. So for the last time on the Heretics Hour, enjoy this great song by Frank Reneke. I certainly will.
Liegen im Westen und Osten, sie liegen in aller Welt, und ihre Helme verrosten, und Kreuz und Hügel zerfällt. Sie liegen verscharrt und versunken, im Massengrab und im Meer, aber es leben Halunken, und die ziehen noch über sie her. Heute tobt mit frechem Gebaren man durch Blätter und Lüge und Glanz. Sie fielen mit 18 Jahren in einem anderen Tanz. Heute tobt mit frechem Gebaren man durch Blätter und Lüge und Glanz. Sie fielen mit 18 Jahren in einem anderen Tanz. Sie waren nicht ausgezogen um Beute und schnöden Gewinn. Was heute verlacht und verlogen, es hatte für sie einen Sinn. Sie hatten ihr junges Leben nicht weniger lieb als sie. Heute Höhnen es hinzugeben, sei reine Idiotie. Heute macht man mit funkelnden Wagen und Dünkel und Mammon starrt. Sie starben an vielen Tagen noch hinterm Stacheldraht. Heute macht man mit funkelnden Wagen und Dünkel und Mammon starrt. Sie starben an vielen Tagen noch hinterm Stacheldraht. Thank you. demonstrieren, mehr Freizeit bei höherem Lohn. Sie mussten ins Feld marschieren, der Vater, der Bruder, der Sohn. Sie gingen die Heimat zu schützen und haben allen entsagt, was kann uns der Einsatz nützen, hat keiner von ihnen gefragt. Sie haben ihr Leben und Sterben dem Vaterland geweiht und wussten nicht, welchen Herben und welche Erbärmlichkeit. Sie haben ihr Leben und Sterben dem Vaterland geweiht und wussten nicht, welchen Herben und welche Erbärmlichkeit. Und welche Erbärmlichkeit!
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is the Heretics Hour on September 30th. 2013, and I'm Carolyn Yeager, and I'm now going to be talking about this book, Hitler's Furies, by a new book by Wendy Lauer, somebody you've never heard of, I'm sure. I've never heard of her, but she is she's from so many different schools that when you anything I see about her, they list her as being from a different university, but she's a visiting professor, or I don't know if she's a full professor or not, in some instances, she's done a lot of traveling and study in Poland and in the Ukraine for this last book, this current book that we're going to be talking about. And I want to mention something that she's done before. It was published in 2011. It's called The Diary of Samuel Goldfarb and the Holocaust in Galicia, and says in parentheses, documenting Holocaust sources in context. So what this was, I'll just read the publisher's description here, is this in-depth study of a Jewish man's diary from Nazi-occupied Poland provides an unfiltered view of the struggle of Samuel Goldfarb, who tried to make sense of and resist the Holocaust that ultimately destroyed him. The diary is complemented by an array of wartime and post-war photographs, newspaper articles, documents, and testimonies that create a fuller picture of Jewish resistance and the perpetration of mass murder in eastern Galicia. Well, Samuel Goldfarb is listed as the author, and Wendy Lauer is listed as the editor. So she either helped him, or this diary was found, and she is what I think. It was found, and then she went through it and, you know, added to it and annotated and so on, and turned it into this book. And of course, we're going to find, as we go through what the story of this book is, we're going to find that she has to be getting her information from so-called survivors, these old people that she's met up with, or who she's read their books or their testimony in trials or something, who have said these things happened. But there's no real evidence that hardly any of the stuff that she talks about actually happened. And a lot of it is just impossible to believe if you are not a total dimwit. But what I found, and I'm going to go through the article at Mail Online, because what I'm interested in is the way these things are portrayed. Not as many people, are portrayed in the news media. And, of course, it's easier for me to do this because I don't have the book. And the book isn't even out yet. According to on the Amazon page, the publication date is something like October 3rd this year. So it's not even out yet. And yet there's a bunch of customer reviews, like maybe 12 or 15 or something. A bunch of them, but they're all very recent. The oldest one I saw there, I was looking all this up last night. And yesterday afternoon, the oldest one that I saw there was September 25th, and there were some just from the 29th, and you know. So I think that these are written by maybe associates of hers, colleagues of hers, friends of hers, people who she's sent the book to, and so on, and they've already written a customer review for her Amazon page because some of them are real long. The first ones are real long, and they're pretty well written, and they're very praiseworthy. You know, I got sick of it. I looked through all of them, and I only found one short little thing that questioned whether this was true, what she was writing about. And then another thing is that the comments to the Mail Online, you know, which is also called the Daily Mail, UK, newspaper were all just believing all of it. Just a few where people wrote and said, maybe this, some of this didn't happen, and how do we know this? Most of this probably didn't happen, and things like that. But just a few of those, most of them, they're like, oh, it's so awful. Oh, people are so evil. Oh, these women are just horrible. I hope they're burning in hell and stuff like that. Although we do also know about the Hasbro program and about how the Israel's got all these trolls going around. So you don't even know, if these comments are sincere or not. But I just wanted to mention that the comments were pretty disappointing. Anyway, I'm going to go through this newspaper article because it shows, has to show at least what's in the book. Plus, it shows how we are, what we are given, you know, as to believe, and how many, like, oh, I started to say, a lot of people will read these newspaper reviews and so on, but not that many people are going to buy the book and read the book. Not that many people at all. I don't even want to read the damn book because it's just, you know, I get upset enough reading this thing. But I think it's valuable, so I'm just going to do it this way. And it's called, the title of the full title of the book is Hitler's Furies, German Women in the Nazi Killing Fields. Now, the Nazi Killing Fields is the East, and that's the term that's been coined by the Holocaust historians, if you want to call them that, for that whole area in Russia and also in Ukraine and Poland, Nazi killing fields. And more because of the problem with the gas chambers, you know, they've put more and more emphasis, as we know, on this idea that they were shooting all these people and killing them one way or another out there in the eastern areas. And mostly they were Jews, and they were just rounding up Jews and taking them and shooting them and then sending them to Treblinka, Belzec, or Sobibor and, you know, gassing them there. And they don't talk much about Auschwitz, Birkenau. So this article here in the Daily Mail is by Tony Rennell, his name doesn't tell us anything about himself. And it starts out, blonde German housewife Erna Petri was returning home after a shopping trip in town when something caught her eye. Six small, nearly naked boys huddled in terror by the side of the country road. Married to a senior SS officer, the 23-year-old knew instantly who they were. They must be the Jews she'd heard about, the ones who'd escaped from a train taking them to an extermination camp. But she was a mother herself with two children of her own. So she humanely took the starving, whimpering youngsters home, calmed them down, and gave them food to eat. Then she led the six of them, the youngest aged six, the oldest 12, into the woods, lined them up on the edge of a pit, and shot them methodically one by one with a pistol in the back of the neck. Now, how this is known, I don't know. But I read somewhere that this woman, Erna Petry, maybe it was in this article, but I saw her somewhere else, was tried and found guilty and spent a whole lot of years in prison after the war for, I guess, for this particular act. Now, how anybody knew about it or what all this is about, I don't know, but I'm not sure it happened the way that they say here, but then it goes on. This schizophrenic combination of warm-hearted mother one minute and cold-blooded killer the next is an enigma, and one that now revealed in a new book based on years of trawling through remote archives puts a crueler than ever spin on the Third Reich. So, of course, you know, we know the effort here is to make the women as bad as the men, to make these Nazis seem like true monsters, and because there's so much progress made in seeing them as real people and not as monsters, and they have to build up this monster again. I really think that even though this Wendy Lauer has appears so okay on the outside, and she wouldn't be engaging in plots like this to make the Germans look worse than they are, or to make the Nazis look worse than they are. But I think that she must be, because the more we read into this, we'll see that there's not very much real evidence for this one here has the most, I guess, the most evidence. They use this first, but I think that a lot of the others don't. And we know what Goldhagen did, and he's with Harvard or something. Then we have Kenneth Walzer, who I've looked at a lot, and he's a Harvard-trained historian and kind of Holocaust specialist too. And he lies all the time. You know, he's lied about all kinds of things. He has no problem with it, and I doubt that this woman does either. Now, I was going to say that she might be Polish, she might be Ukrainian. She looks like she could be Polish, but you know, I can't tell by how people look. But it could be that she's Slavic, and for that reason, because maybe what she knows about her family, or what her family's told her or taught her, or what she grew up with. Maybe that has caused her to be so anti-Nazi that she would, you know, look for ways to make them look even worse than ever and not allow any kind of rehabilitation to take place. That's just best that I can figure on her. Anyway, it says Erna was by no means an aberration. In a book she tellingly calls Hitler's Furies, Holocaust historian Professor Wendy Lauer has unearthed the complicity of tens of thousands of German women, tens of thousands, many more than previously imagined, in the sort of mass, monstrous, murderous activities that we would like to think the so-called gentler sex were incapable of. The Holocaust has generally been seen as a crime perpetrated by men. The vast majority of those accused at Nuremberg and other war crimes trials were men. The few women ever called to account were notorious concentration camp guards, the likes of Irma Grise and Ilse Koch, whose evil was so extreme, of course it wasn't at all, but that's what they say here, whose evil was so extreme they could be explained away as freaks and beasts, not really women at all. Okay, they're not. These women are not women. Ultra macho Nazi Germany was a man's world. the vast majority of women had, on Hitler's orders, confined their activities to Kinder, Kuche, Kirche, children, kitchen, and church. Thus, when it came to responsibility for the Holocaust and other evils of the Third Reich, they were off the hook. I can't get all of this in here. I might expand my window a little bit here. But that, argues Lauer, is simplistic nonsense. Women were drawn into the morally bankrupt conspiracy that was Hitler's Germany as thoroughly as men were. At a lower level in most cases, when it came to direct action, the guilty just the same. Now, this has to be, he says Lauer argues this. So this has to come from her, that the theme is that the Hitler's Germany was morally bankrupt, it was a conspiracy, and that women were drawn into it, just like the men were. Well, naturally, you know, I mean, they would be. I mean, but in any nation where you are united against enemies and so on, where you're functioning with your people, the women are going to be supporting the men and are going to be helping. And in all of these resistance groups where they were doing atrocious atrocities to Germans, German soldiers and so on, the women were playing a part and women were operating in that. They're never blamed for it. They're all seen as heroes, as heroic for what they were doing. So it's easy to see through this stuff, but you have to make sure that, you know, it's mentioned. Ironically, it was the professional carers who were the first to be caught in this evil web. From the moment the Nazis came to power and imposed policies of Aryan racial purity, countless nurses, their aprons filled with morphine vials and needles, routinely slaughtered the physically disabled and mentally defective. What a way of writing this is. Did this guy make this up, or did this kind of wording come from the book too? Nurses with their aprons filled with morphine vials and needles were routinely slaughtering, they used that word slaughtered the physically disabled and mentally defective. Okay, and then, now here's a real interesting part, because they bring up a woman named Pauline Kneisler. And Pauline Kneisler, it says, worked at Grafenegg Castle, a euthanasia hospital in southern Germany, and toured mental institutions, selecting 70 patients a day. At the castle, they were gassed, which she decided was not that bad, because death by gas doesn't hurt. Well, that's all they say about her, you know? Let's see. She might come up again later, but that's all they say about her. And so I looked her up. And what I found was that there was something in somebody's dissertation called Medicine After the Holocaust. Or no, this was at a website, medicineafterTheHolocaust.org, something else in someone's dissertation. And they talk about this, and it sounds like this is where they got this. I'm trying to remember there's a big connection here. Maybe I looked at the book. I don't know. Anyway, this Pauline, what's known about Pauline Kneisler is that it says in this on this website, the T4 nurses had been employed at Grafenegg, which was a hospital that they did use for euthanasia, from January until December 1940, and had gained their experience in the euthanasia program there. The selection of the nurses that were ordered, that is, they call it, the German word was forced mobilization for the war effort. They were ordered to be a part of what was going on at this hospital, was accomplished with the assistance of certain trustworthy contact persons from several other psychiatric institutions. I don't know about that. After this selection, a personal evaluation of this group of nurses, including checks for political and professional trustworthiness, was done by the members of the Chancellery of the Fuhrer. Well, that's pretty normal, that they wanted nurses for this very sensitive kind of work that they could depend on and that were trustworthy and so on, and they would do checks on them. That's natural. Descriptions of the interviews, there were some interviews with these nurses, do not indicate particular pressure when questioned if the nurses wanted to partake in the killings. See, they use the word killings all the time when it wasn't killings. It was euthanasia can be called that, but that's not really the way it's done. And then it says one nurse, Pauline Kneisler, stated. So here they have a little bit of an investigation. They have some words from this Pauline Kneisler, and I bet this is what is used everywhere. And I didn't see anything more than this in here. All right, I see now what's going on with the dissertation. What is said here, what is quoted here from Pauline Kneisler, comes from a paper by P. Heberer about the Hadamar facility and euthanasia facility, and it's his dissertation at the University of Maryland in Ann Arbor, and he used the university microfilms to get it. And so this was written for somebody's dissertation, and this is what was found on the microfilm about this Pauline Kneisler when she was questioned about things. And she was not prosecuted either. She says, "We were told that every creature should be allowed a merciful death. This certainly made sense to me, although on the other hand, I was irritated that it should be I who was asked to do this. I would have preferred to act as a Red Cross nurse. I was asked if I wanted to participate. Whoever didn't agree could back out. They asked them, they told them they didn't have to do it. We received a few minutes to think about things. Herr Blankenberg left the room during this time. We didn't discuss the matter further amongst ourselves. No one said that she couldn't do it. We didn't feel very good about it, but we had no moral reservations." So they didn't think it was immoral. They weren't happy that they were the ones asked to do it. But as good Germans at that time, I suppose they felt they should do whatever they were, you know, do their part. But they didn't have any moral reservations about it. Truthfully, the people who were euthanized were very bad cases. And they always want to make out that they were, people who are just older, people who they just, a little bit confused or something. That's not true. And these were extremely, extremely bad cases. And my own opinion, I'll just throw it in here, is that particularly if you're in a situation like Germany was, and you're in a war like that, and you're a fairly small, country of all the same people, and you're all pulling together for the good of your nation and of all the Germans, that people who are really in the way, like these people were at that time, because they required a lot of care, and they weren't ever going to recover or be anything. They were just like, mostly in the case of vegetables, or they were highly deformed, and different things like that are mentally, insane. And I've read about some of these people there. And the other thing to recognize that is never brought up is that nowadays we have the ability to look into the womb with our different x-rays, and not x-rays, but something harmless. I can't think of what it's called. But we can see if a fetus is developing abnormally. And what it is, the parents are told about it, and they can even tell what it is and what it's going to be and so on. And they have the choice to end their, to abort that child, basically. And many, many choose to do that. And it's not considered death or killing or anything like that. But in those days, they didn't have that. And there were a lot of deformed and mental, you know, mentally deformed and so on, people being born. And Germany, because of the bad situation during between the wars and so on, I don't know, they say they have a lot of these cases, a lot of these people, a lot of very bad births and so on, and extremely, extremely bad people who never would, you know, be able to function at all in any way. And I think it's better. If you don't have endless resources of people to take care of, I don't see why these people would want to be living if they're, you know, if they're really the very bad ones. So anyway, continuing here, nurses' involvement in the early days mainly consisted of accompanying the patients from the different institutions to the killing center. See, they call it a killing center. This is this guy's dissertation still. No, this is something else. That was the dissertation before Pauline's comments. This is from, now guess this little part I'm reading now is from an article in Nursing called Nursing in the Third Reich by a person named Stepp or Steppe. And it was in the History of Nursing Journal. So this is just taken from an article in a nursing journal. And so you don't know how good it is, but and how much they care about the accuracy of what's being said, but somebody wrote this and put it in this magazine, or the magazine accepted it. And so they say that nurses' involvement in the early days mainly consisted of accompanying the patients from the different institutions to the killing center after the transport buses arrived at Hadamar and the other killing centers. You know, the nurses helped the patients undress and accompanied them to the office to be seen by the physician, to be photographed, and then to the waiting room and the gas chamber. Well, I don't know if they went into a gas chamber at all. There's so much controversy and conflicting ideas about this. I don't think they used gas chambers at all. But anyway, this is just some of what you can find when you look it up, and this is it. You know, that's all there is. That's all there is. And yet they're writing here as though they know all this stuff. And this, and they say that this Pauline Kneisler toured mental institutions, selecting 70 patients a day. That has to be a lie. If this guy has written it in this article in the Mail, he must have found it in the book or found something like that in the book. That's all I can say. And it's not true. So, because this Pauline Kneisler said that she was just a regular nurse who was asked to participate in this, and she didn't have any special kind of authority. I don't think they'd have her going around selecting 70 patients a day. That's crazy. And then they say that she said at the castle they were gassed. No, she's not saying this. The reporter's saying at the castle they were gassed, which she decided was not that bad because death by gas doesn't hurt. Well, supposedly she said that. She might have said that, but it's not in this little piece that I found. And I don't know. I suppose it's in the book, and maybe this Lowry has more there, but they didn't put any more of her testimony in this article. And maybe, or it wasn't on this guy's dissertation. Maybe he didn't think it was bad enough. I don't know. It wasn't what he wanted to have in there, but this doesn't fit from what I found, and I know that so many just bald-faced lies are told by people you think wouldn't tell them because they have these academic degrees. But Ken, as I already said, Ken Walzer tells them, and doesn't bother him, and no, see, because nobody questions these people,
you can't get to them to question them. And it's hard to get to the information that they say they have available to them also. Anyway, so that's it about Pauline, I think. And so the article here goes on. Meanwhile, midwives were betraying a whole generation of German women by reporting defects in unborns and newborns and recommending abortions and euthanasia, as well as sterilization of mothers. Now, that doesn't make sense. Because they don't say they are betraying Jewish women. They say they are betraying German women. And we know the policy in Germany was to have as many children as possible and not to abort any child. And so midwives couldn't have been reporting defects that weren't there and recommending abortions and euthanasia for healthy babies and sterilization of mothers. That could never have happened. And they make it sound like that was the policy. Or somehow these evil midwife women were doing this. It doesn't even make sense. I don't know where this kind of stuff comes from. He goes on from the outset. Okay, this is, he's quoting Lauer in her book. From the outset, Lauer concludes, women made cruel life and death decisions, eroding moral sensibilities. Well, this means nothing. This is taken from the book. Lauer said this, but what does it mean? Women, just women, made cruel life and death decisions, eroding moral sensibilities. Well, we don't have anything that, you know, that refers to, so what are we supposed to make of it? A line had been crossed, the reporter writes. It was no big step when the racial purification process turned to the final solution of exterminating millions of Jews. Well, we know that's the story they like to go by. That this is what they pushed, that they started out with this euthanasia, and then that led them to not having any scruples, and they, you know, killing more and more people until they just went ahead and exterminated millions of Jews in gas chambers. That's the line that they have always given for a long time anyway. So it goes on that Jews were the enemy and their annihilation, the answer, was taken for granted by millions of women who would later deny knowing what was going on under their noses. Well, they were told that Jews were the enemy, but they weren't told that annihilation was the answer, and they were trying to get them out of the country. Okay, deport them. He says, Lauer, though, dubs them primary witnesses of the Holocaust. So while these women were just thousands, hundreds of thousands of women who said they didn't know that there was anything like gas chambers or any extermination or anything going on, which is true, the men didn't either. Lauer, though, says they are primary witnesses, you see. So this woman is nuts. She's this tells you right here that she is not responsible. She's not writing something responsible. She's writing an attack piece. So it goes on, the worst outrages took place in the Wild East, they call it, Hitler's newly acquired territories in Poland, Ukraine, and other parts of overrun Russia. At least 500,000 young women joined in this colonization process and became accomplices to genocide on an unprecedented scale. Now, here again, it's normal and natural when you colonize an area, you know, when the men have to go there, women go too. Women go as wives, and women go as support personnel. They go as secretaries and office workers and so on. They needed a lot of these people, but I don't know how many were actually there. You don't hear about very many women there, but he says. Oh, at least 500,000 young women. Well, they don't know. But they say He writes, a mass of secretaries, for example, typed the orders to kill and filed details of massacres. This placed them at the very center of the Nazi murder machinery. Well, you know, they weren't typing orders to kill. They were filling details of massacres.
They weren't filing the details of massacres. I don't think such things were filed. I don't think they were typing up orders like that. But they just assumed that such things were going on, and then they say these secretaries were doing it, and therefore they were part of the Nazi murder machine, and they chose to shut their eyes and benefit from their proximity to power.
But picnicking in the country, now they constantly are insisting that these, because they have a few photographs of some of it, they insist that all these German men and women were out on picnics all the time while they had all this important work to do. But, you know, they were just rollicking around in the countryside and killing people while they're at it. But they listen to this. Picnicking in the country on their days off, how did they miss the mounds of mass graves? The gagging smell of rotting corpses whose clothes and possessions plundered from ghettos or confiscated at camps and killing fields, did they think they were cataloging for redistribution back home? There weren't mounds of mass graves, and there wasn't a smell of rotting corpses. That's why, you know, why are they assuming that that was all there? You see, they assume that this is going on, and then they make these people guilty for involving themselves in it without any care or concern for these victims. But this is just not the way it was. And they say that they plundered clothes and possessions from ghettos. And, you know, I don't think that they were taking most of this clothing and sending it back to Germany. I don't think the Germans wanted this clothes. They did take care of some, mostly shoes, and they did, you know, if it's nice clothing, they kept it. They were very careful not to waste anything. But supposedly these women were doing all this and they knew all about it and they went along with it. And then they say train loads of booty went back to Germany in what Lauer calls the biggest campaign of organized robbery in history. Well, you know, train loads of booty were not going back to Germany. Maybe there was a train here and there with some in it, but, you know, they exaggerate it. And then she calls it the biggest campaign of organized robbery in history. This really makes me hate this woman. She looks like a pretty nice woman, you know, decent woman, but she's not. She probably thinks she is. She, you know, certainly has decided what side she's on. And this, you know, the biggest organized robbery in history. Well, I'm sure we can look to the Jews for whatever would be the biggest robbery in history. And German women, she charges, were among its prime agents and beneficiaries. She's just trying to make Germans look even worse by making their women look like monsters, which I've already said is pretty clear. Even more caught up in the criminal madness were administrators such as Lieselot Meyer, who worked so closely with her strutting boss, an SS officer, that they were almost indistinguishable. She joined him on shooting parties in the snow, hunting and killing Jews for sport. Well, you know, they've got a picture of Lieselot Meyer here, and she is a kind of a well-known character from infamous. From all the things that were said about her. And I think that these things, it's like with Koch, what was Koch's first name? From Buchenwald, that woman. The people in the camps, or if they were in ghettos or whatever, told all these stories about these Germans. And they made up all kinds of stuff. And then all this was repeated. And these accusations were made and believed. But it's not, there is this idea of shooting parties in the snow I've read about. It's nonsense. It's crazy. It's like they sent Jews out to run around outdoors in some, you know, fields or something. And then they went out and hunting them like they're, you know, hunting quail or hunting foxes or something and shooting at them for sport. I don't believe this. I don't believe it at all. It's just a big fairy tale that these evil survivors dreamed up. And they had her, you know, said that she was doing it too. Now, if she was working for a German SS officer as an administrator, I don't know what her job was. They don't say what her job was. She was under this SS officer. They don't say what his job is, and they don't say what his name is either. You know, women weren't allowed to go around doing things like this. Listen, there's some more stuff that they say about her. They really go after us. In the early phases of the Holocaust, massacres were generally by shooting. Yeah. In her area of Belarus, okay, they were in Belarus, she coordinated the arrangements with the executioners and even decided who lived and who died. Oh, sure, they didn't have women doing things like that. She spared the life. Not only were women always subordinate to the men, but they felt that women were a little more delicate and shouldn't be exposed to a lot of stuff like that. So this would never, you know, she would never been put in charge of things like this. She spared the life of the Jewish woman who did her hair, while another secretary removed a woman from the death line who hadn't yet finished the sweater she was knitting for her. So this Lysolot, like the woman who did her hair and spared her, wow, who said that? Somebody said that. And then another secretary, not Lysolot, removed a man from the death line, didn't have death lines, who hadn't yet finished the sweater, A woman from the death line who was knitting a sweater for her and hadn't finished it. See, these are the nutty kind of things that these survivors tell. There's no truth to them. And is any of this sourced anywhere? No, it's just mentioned here. It's just thrown in here, you know, and as though you don't have to prove any of it. Then it says secretaries had another important role, too. After each operation, it was usual for the SS killers, many of them drunk on schnapps, to seek solace in the women's quarters. Oh, yeah, and they always say they're drinking schnapps. The German men never drank anything but schnapps, and they were SS killers, and they were getting drunk a lot and out there in the killing fields. And they would go to the women's quarters, that means the women who were prisoners, whether for sexual release or a shoulder to cry on after the exertions of mass execution. Aye, aye, aye. In support of the men, women even manned refreshment tables during execution so the killers could take a break. So they call them killers. And the women manned refreshment tables while these mass executions were going on. That is just, you know, unbelievable. Germans don't behave that way. They would not have been allowed to behave that way. And they had... you know, anybody who knows anything about it knows that. So this woman is just plain lying and getting away with it. Now, she has written what are supposed to be academic papers. But this book, she wouldn't even have titled it because the publishers probably had a lot to do with it to make it more sensational and more saleable and so on. And she obviously didn't have a problem with that. Now we get back to Erna Petry. It says, but much worse than these active accomplices who were manning refreshment tables and so on were the women who actually killed, often the wives of SS officers. Erna Petry, callous dispatcher of those six Jewish boys, was one such Frau. She had followed her husband to Poland and lived in a mansion overseeing a vast estate for the race and resettlement office of the SS with subhuman Slavs as slaves. You know, they love to say that too. Well, if you were working out there in that, and you had a very responsible position out there in that area, you might have lived in a nice house, but it wouldn't have been a mansion unless they had requisitioned something that was kind of like a mansion. If you would have some of the Slavic people living around there working at your house and working for you. And they probably didn't mind doing it either. They weren't slaves. They weren't working as slaves. They didn't take slaves. But they loved to say that. Another SS wife, Liesel Wilhaus, wife of a camp commandant, used to sit on the balcony of their house and take pot shots at Jewish prisoners with her rifle. Now, there's a reference to that commandant of the camp that's involved in the Schindler's List book. He supposedly went out on his balcony and shot the prisoners down below just for sport or something. Well, now they've got a woman doing it, the wife of an SS officer. I guess he was the camp commandant. They don't say what camp that I could see of. But I just mentioned this woman doing this. Also, somebody just said it. Somebody wrote it in their book or in their memoirs or whatever. Just wrote this kind of thing. It's being picked up. Also in Poland was Vera Wolow, whose husband, Julius, commanded a police battalion, ordered in 1942 to round up 11,000 Jewish inhabitants of a small town for transportation to Treblinka for liquidation. Well, if there was a roundup of Jews for transportation to Treblinka, it wasn't for liquidation purposes. But anyway, I don't know that there was, but they say that this Vera Wolow sat by her husband in the front seat of the lorry that led a convoy of killers to the town and stood in the market square brandishing a whip as nearly 1,000 who resisted the roundup collapsed in the summer heat were beaten to death or shot. Good grief. And she was pregnant at the time. A further incongruity. Yeah, it's in Congress, all right. They did not allow wives of commandants or SS officers or anything to be whipping people in the market square. You know, that's just crazy. And she's pregnant, too. That's just another one of these nutty stories that are told by these Jews there. In the Ukraine, 22-year-old secretary Johanna Altwater played an even more prominent role in a massacre while working for regional commissar Wilhelm Westerheide. Now, at least they're giving the guy's name. It might be, you know, this might be real people here. But during the liquidation of a Jewish ghetto, Fraulein Johanna, as she was known, or Hanna, as she was known, was seen in her riding breeches prodding men, women, and children into a truck like a cattle herder. So, you know, here again, she's a secretary to this guy. And they love this image of the Nazi woman in riding breeches and throwing a whip around and so on, riding horses and being very dominating. You know, they love to put forth that image. And these women were not like that. I don't know. These are just stories from the people in the ghetto telling their wild stories. So then they have a photograph here that they stick in of Hitler and Eva Braun, which has nothing to do with the story or this book or anything. They just want to, again, show. And it's such a nice picture. And they're both dressed so nicely, and she's walking. They're coming downstairs, and she's one step behind him, which is what she would have felt was proper, the proper thing to do. She never pushed herself forward. And they just want to make you think that, well, there's Eva Braun. She was an evil woman like the rest of them must have been. And then they say that this we're still with this Johanna Altvater, who was wear riding breeches. She marched into a building being used as a makeshift hospital and through the children's ward, eyeing each bedridden child. Can you imagine? She's looking at every child in there, sick children. Then she stopped, picked one up, took it to the balcony, threw the child to the pavement three floors below. She did the same with other children. Some died, and even those who survived were seriously injured. Not believable. Her specialty, or as one survivor put it, her nasty habit, was killing children. One observer noted that Altvater often lured children with sweets. When they came to her and opened their mouths, she shot them in the mouth with the small pistol that she kept at her side. Ha! And, they were in a ghetto. They were in a Jewish ghetto. I don't know what they were doing there, but that's where she was so mean to all these Jewish children. And these people in the writing comments are believing this stuff. They act like they're believing this. I can't believe this horrible stuff these people did. Oh, God. On another occasion, she beckoned a toddler over, then grabbed him tightly by the legs and slammed his head against the wall as if she were banging the dust out of a mat. Now, again, there's that same old image transferred from SS men to a woman who works with the SS, where they like to pick up these little kids by the legs and smash their heads against the side of the truck or a wall or something. Concrete, for no reason, just because they're sadistic, which none of that ever happened. And those were stories that Poles told. The Poles told those stories all the time. And this ghetto could very well have been in Poland. These are creepy Polish stories. Then they say, writes, she threw the lifeless child at the feet of his father, who later testified, "Such sadism from a woman I have never seen. I will never forget this." Yeah. I bet he didn't. He never saw it. But they're liars. They're liars. Close to the mass shooting site where the ghetto inhabitants were herded to await their deaths, Westerheide, that's the man, and his deputies partied with some German women. Altvater was among the revelers, drinking and eating at a banqueting table amid the bloodshed. A music playing in the background mixed with the sound of gunfire. From time to time, one of the Germans would get up, walk to the shooting site, kill a few people, and then return to the party. Is this not getting beyond, belief? Is this not getting just incredible? What do you make of this? And he's just writing this stuff in this article, and it's supposedly from this book. A little girl approached... Then violence to children was also the trademark of Gestapo wife and mother Josephine Block, who liked to carry a riding crop, there it is again, and lash out at prisoners waiting to be deported. That's because these dumb Polish and Jews didn't know any better than to keep repeating the same story over and over again and put it on, a different person. And whoever was being talked about, whatever German was being talked about, they accused them of doing these same things. A little girl approached this Gestapo wife and mother, crying and begging for her life. "I will help you," Block declared, grabbed the girl by the hair, smashed her with her fists, then pushed her to the ground and stamped on her head until she was dead. Desperate Jewish parents often approached Block to ask for help, assuming that, as a young woman and mother, she'd be sympathetic. But she would use her pram to ram Jews whom she encountered on the streets and was said to have actually killed a small Jewish child with it. Such treatment is an affront to any sense of humanity, let alone womanhood. And then they say that all the more so because most of these crimes went unpunished. Well, I wonder why.
Because they never happened, that's why. They say, he writes here that Erna Petry was the exception and spent more than 30 years in prison. This is the one who supposedly shot those four prison boys. I don't know that she was a sadistic woman. I don't know the real story of that, but in any case, she went to prison for 30 years. But they say that the others were either tried and acquitted or released after questioning. Why? Because the witness testimony was baloney, and it was known that these charges against him weren't worth anything. And that's why they were released after questioning or tried and acquitted. But they're trying to make out in this book that they were all guilty of what they were accused of, and they shouldn't have been let go. They got away with it. Let's see. Is there anything more here that I really need to show? Lauer says, to assume that violence is not a feminine characteristic and that women are not capable of mass murder has obvious appeal. It allows for hope that at least half the human race will not devour the other, that it will protect children and so safeguard the future. So there's that Jewish attack on white people. On, you know, Germans are the ultimate white Europeans, and so all white Europeans are guilty of just being such monsters that they'll just devour each other. And now we find that we won't be saved by the women because the women are just as bad as the men. That's what this is all about. And she ends up saying that at least 500,000 women witnessed and contributed to the operations and terror of Hitler's genocidal war. And here's a direct quote. The Nazi regime mobilized a generation of young women who were conditioned to accept violence, to incite it, and to commit it. This fact has been suppressed and denied by the very women who were swept up in the regime as by those who perpetrated the violence with impunity. But genocide is also women's business. When given the opportunity, women too will engage in it, even its bloodiest aspects. So, you know, the fact that these women denied that they had done any of these things, it doesn't mean anything. They're just in denial. They're lying. Well, this is the kind of lying book this is. It's going to be come out on October 3rd at the price of $18.99. German Women in the Nazi Killing Fields by Wendy Lauer. And, you know, I don't know what to do about stuff like this. What do we do about books like this? At least we need to tell people and be knowledgeable about it so we can explain to people why they're so phony. Well, good night. Thanks for listening. We're out of time, and see you next week.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.